Welcome once again, folks, to allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And unfortunately, minus podcast UGC today. Unfortunately. Yeah. Just due to a little bit of scheduling conflict at the last minute, we weren't able to get them on. But that's okay. We'll have them on probably next week if everything goes according to plan.
Yep.
Because plans can be fickle.
And of course, because I am a psychic and last week I slipped up and said we were going to be talking about the Star Trek RPG, that's what we're talking about today. and I have no show notes for this.
Those role-playing games. Well, you're much more familiar with the system than I am.
Yeah, but this is going to contain...
I was simply a player. You were the actual game master in this past game we just had.
Yeah, this is probably going to contain significantly more rage than a normal podcast, because when I don't have show notes, I tend to rage. But, and this is also going to...
It's more real, more visceral.
This is also going to include a lot of just general role-playing theory and how it's applied in the Star Trek RPG.
Prepare to nerd out, folks.
Yeah. So for reference, we are talking about the Star Trek role-playing game published by Last Unicorn, which is, of course, way out of print. And there have been a number of newer ones since then. But this is
the most common one, though, isn't it?
Huh?
From Last Unicorn?
I don't know. I think there was one from another copier that was different.
I mean, I know whenever I discuss Star Trek role-playing games, either with people that I meet, you know, in real life or on the web somewhere, you know, mostly the Star Trek Online forums, typically this is the system that everyone references.
Well, maybe this is the common one. I know there's been a newer one since now that's
is there?
Different. That's like, it's really? Just 2d6 all the time. It's a different setup. But, all right, so the general... And again, this may sound a little weird to anyone listening who doesn't play RPGs, but just bear with me.
Well, maybe you should go, what is an RPG?
All right, what is an RPG? Okay, so an RPG, or role-playing game, is a game in which a bunch of people sit down at a table, everyone creates a single character that they control, except for the Game Master. The Game Master controls the rest of the universe. And basically, it's at its best, it's an interactive storytelling technique. And it's like, you know, it's like reading a novel... You're like, hey, I wish this character would do something different, but you could actually make that happen.
Yep.
At its best. At its worst, it's a slog through a bunch of goblin-infested dungeons. But anyway.
See, power gaming.
Power gaming, or just D&D in general. Oops.
Not to say that power gaming is bad, necessarily. There's some people do it, and people will enjoy it. That's more than fine for them.
All right. And usually, you resolve conflict by rolling dice. Because, you know, you have that old cops and robbers routine where it's like, I shot you. No, you didn't. You did not shoot me. Well, I got some dice to roll and say I did.
Yep.
And so in this system, the way that you roll dice is you roll a number of d6s equal to your base stat, and then you pick the highest one, and then you add your skill level to it. So, like, for example, the most basic would be...
You just blew my mind. Yeah. You just threw so much math at the audience.
So much math. Okay, so, for example, if you fire a phaser, that's going to be... You're going to roll a number of d6s equal to... By which I mean a six-sided die, equal to your dexterity. So let's say your dexterity is 3. You'd roll 3 dice. You'd pick the highest one, let's say it was a 4, and then you would add your phaser skill, which is, let's say, a 3 as well.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have a total of 6, and you ask your game master if 6 is high enough to successfully hit whatever you were shooting at, and if so, you've hit them. Congratulations.
Hooray!
And if, like, normally if it was like, you know, if that's like a computer's test or anything, you've succeeded at whatever it was you were trying to do, whether it was trying to stop the warp core from malfunctioning or trying to pilot the shuttle... Or trying to get free drinks, whatever. In the case of a phaser, that's a little different, because then you roll damage, and you don't automatically succeed at knocking someone down with a phaser shot.
Yep.
But that's a whole... We'll get into the phasers a little bit later. So, just...
phasers.
Phasers, yeah. That's going to be interesting. All right, so, just, like, off the bat, Star Trek... It's not surprising that Star Trek was made into a role-playing game.
Really?
No, I don't think so at all. The fan base of Star Trek is totally the same people who play role-playing games. Obviously, not all of them. My mom is a huge Star Trek fan, and
there's a cross-section of fans, if you will.
Yeah, and there's a lot of overlap. A lot of role-playing people also like Star Trek, and vice versa.
Like us.
Yeah, like
for example, right?
and so it's an interesting universe, and there's a lot of instances where, especially when you're watching like Captain Kirk running around. Doing ridiculously badass stuff. If you play role-playing games, you're like, oh man,
Kirk Hammerfist,
that guy is totally a player character, because no one else would be able to get away with that kind of crap. And so, you know, it's pretty natural that they would make one. There are some fairly unique challenges when you're playing this game, and like from a storytelling perspective, the first being, who do you make? Like, first of all, you have to decide if you want to go with what the game expects you to do, which is that everyone is an ensign. Or if you want to have them be in command of their own ship. Now,
you're talking like character creation and
yeah,
such,
character,
right? For character creation purposes, the book is specifying that everyone's starting out fresh out of the academy as an ensign, right?
Yes. And okay. thanks for clarifying that, because it's a really good thing I have Bob here, because if he wasn't here, I would just be going on so many tangents that no one would understand what I was talking about. But okay, so yeah.
This is I know how to talk to the common people.
I sound like a bourgeoisie asshole. But okay, so yeah, the book assumes that you are going to make a character, and your characters are all going to be ensigns fresh out of the academy. Now, that's going to be a little weird to anyone who's first picking up this game, because it's like, wait a minute, when you think of all the Star Trek stories, they're always about the command crew, with the occasional side episode about, like, the lower decks or what have you.
Like Kirk, Spock, McCoy, yeah.
Picard, Sulu. Data. You know, as a rule, your players aren't going to want to be Ensign Ricky, who either dies or spends the entire episode fixing a plasma junction. They're going to want to be the captain and the tactical officer and the helmsman and all those people who get to do important stuff. That's what they're going to want to do, and that's a much more interesting story. So, first of all, you have to change some rules right off the bat, because, like, the game, if you want to start as a higher-ranking officer in this game, you have to pay for that.
Well, not change rules necessarily. This is something that you, as the game master, were taking license over to fit the story and the setting that you were setting up. In this case, for our game, we were, in fact, playing the command crew of the ship we were on.
Right.
And we also had secondary characters who were, in fact, like ensigns, and they were the away team characters. But
right.
Anyway.
But that was me changing a rule. Because in the base rules, if you want to start off playing a higher-ranking officer, you have to pay points for it. Which is a really weird dynamic, because it means that the character starting off as a commander is going to be worse at everything than the player starting off as an ensign, because he spent a bunch of his character points on his promotion advantage.
Right.
Because this isn't like D&D where you get like a class and then are given a bunch and then are given certain abilities from your class. Like, you get a bunch of skill points and then you spend them as you will. Although you do also get, back it up a little bit to the first part of the character creation with this book. You have to do a lot of copying.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because
so much.
Because first you have to take your race template, and everyone from a certain race gets a certain number of skills, because this game is racist. Humans get a bunch of athletics and science and some history. Klingons, of course, get weaponry, because every Klingon knows how to use a batleth, I guess.
Every Klingon.
So you have to copy all that down. Then you have to pick what branch of service you're in Starfleet in. And then you have to copy down all the skills that gives you.
Right.
And then you finally get some skills to spend for yourself. And you make a fairly personalized character. And I do like that these pre-generated packages tend to make for characters that are more balanced. And less of the character who is super good at doing one thing, and that's like all he does. Because I'm sure we've all played games with that character where he's like, I am, and usually it's fighting, but sometimes it's something else. Sometimes it's, I am the super best hacker, I can hack anything in the entire universe, but I can barely cross the street to get groceries. You know? Say things like that. And you just don't see those kind of characters in Starfleet very often, because Starfleet is a military organization. They need people who can do more than one thing. So I do like how that works, but all the copying is just kind of annoying. And it's also, the book is just really terribly formatted.
Well, let's put a pin right there. How would you change it?
How would I change that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
would you have it like where it's, for instance, like D&D 4th Ed right now, or Dungeons and Dragons 4th Edition for those that weren't familiar with the shorthand, where they have like, for instance, they have a bunch of cards for powers that for each class, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Would you do something like that, or
I would not. I am not going to go into why I don't like 4th Edition, because this week we would be in here for 4 more hours talking about why I don't like 4th Edition.
But, well, thank God we're not in all things D&D.
Yeah, well, not yet. Anyway, okay, so. What I would have done to change this is I would have done a Burning Wheel sort of situation. And Burning Wheel is an even more obscure role-playing game, which I really like. And the character generation works by you pick life paths. And the life paths, rather than strictly laying out what your skills are, instead they give you a certain number of points and access to specific skills. And you can choose which one you want to take, which means you only write down the skills you want as opposed to all of them. And it just makes the character creation process much more organic. So that's what I would have done. But the book is just terribly laid out, what I was saying before. Like, one of my favorites is in the character creation section for the Next Generation, they have the pages formatted to try to look like the control panels from Star Trek.
The LCARS interface.
Is that what it's called?
Library Computer Access Retrieval System, LCARS.
Ah, my nerd points. Okay, so, like, you know how those panels have different colored, basically, like, rectangles on them, and that's like where the buttons are. The book has the same thing, except those different colored like rectangles don't correspond to anything. So like I had a bunch of players who forgot to write down certain skills because they were in a different colored box.
Oh yeah, well that's because of the way we've all been taught is that if this is in a certain area, you know, for instance in this shaded area, that's all you get. You know, right. It never indicated that it wasn't. Was
exactly.
The thing.
And then the DS9 book does the same thing, except in the DS9 book, half the skills are italicized for no reason. And I, you know, at first I thought maybe that was like special skills. You only got some of the time, but no, you get all the italicized skills, but only half of them are italicized. So it's like, wait, why did you only italicize half the skills? Like, I honestly tried to figure out why that was, and I could not. So this book is like, I think there was like one book that was worse, more poorly formatted than this. And I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. This also has like, in the Deep Space Nine book, the character generation. If you want to play a Starfleet character, you have to skip all the way to the back of the book to find the stuff for that. In Next Generation book, there's like this weird character building tutorial before it has told you what any of this stuff means. It's right. Like, write down all of, you know, it's like you get all these skills and all these edges and all these specialties. And you're like, what is an edge? Why are you telling me that I have them? Because it hasn't told you what anything means yet. So they have the character creation tutorial at the beginning of the character creation section instead of the end where it should be. And right. It is in like every other book. But right. For some reason they decided to do things differently. Because, you know, they're different.
Not to mention it's cut in half, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like there's this...
I mean, part of it was in like the front of the book. The other part was like in the later half of the book.
Yeah, it was. And then like...
That was confusing.
Of course, the skills and the advantages are not where they should be. And it's all really badly laid out. But once you get past that, you do end up with some characters that are fairly nicely rounded. You can also, they also give you these packages you can take where they've basically spent all your points for you. And I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain that those packages don't give you enough stuff. Because I looked at, like, Bob chose one, and, like...
Well, all my stuff was done with packages.
Right, like, Bob made his entire character using the pre-made packages. And I looked at his character versus, like, all the characters who had chosen just buy their stuff with their own, with, like, the points they got instead of having it spent for them. And Bob's character just had way lower skills and, like, way fewer of them. And I don't really know why that was. And, like, I double-checked the math on the other characters, and it just seemed like Bob wasn't getting as much as he should be getting. So that's kind of weird.
I don't know. I didn't feel like I was an ineffective character, though, either of my characters.
No, I mean, you certainly...
I mean, they both function just fine.
Certainly, Chief Engineer McQuayo was perfectly fine at his job, and there was no complaints there. It was just a little weird on the math. And so once you've created your character, you kind of have to figure out, like, before you even create your characters, you have to figure out what kind of game you want to play. And this is a little bit challenging, again, from a game mastering perspective, because Starfleet is this giant organization, right? And when there's a problem, Starfleet, in theory, is not going to send, like, one ship to deal with it if it's a really serious problem. And if the problem gets worse, you would always call for reinforcements. And that is a huge drama killer. In any game where the players can call for backup if things get bad, that's not good. It's mm-hmm. no bueno. Because it just sucks all the drama right out of it. It's like, oh, well, we don't know if we can solve this problem. We'll just call for some help. And then our friends can solve it for us. And it's like, that's no good. And you'll notice that, for the most part, each Star Trek show comes up with some excuse why the characters on that show can't call for help. In TOS and TNG and in Enterprise, too, it was because they were off exploring the frontier. In Voyager, it was because they were literally on the other side of the galaxy. In Deep Space Nine, it was because they were on a remote station that wasn't even in Federation space.
Well, then Dominion War.
Well, yeah. And Deep Space Nine changed it up with the Dominion War.
Right.
And by the Dominion War, their reasoning behind it was that by that point, the characters were, like, you know, sort of an elite crew, and they had, like, a lot of experience. So they were given, like, the really hard missions that they didn't trust anyone else with.
Right.
And, like, the covert missions. And they were also, like, leading a fleet, even though, as you pointed out earlier, the Defiant is not a very good
terrible command ship. It just is.
And the reason for that, I think, is that, like, the reason why it doesn't make sense for it to be a command ship is that a command ship needs to have very powerful sensors and very powerful communications equipment because it needs to be able to track what's going on at all times.
And who did they have at one little station? Nog. Coordinating the entire fleet or task force that they had.
Whereas the Defiant is a warship that has a lot of guns. It's not built for that.
Yeah. It's,
so that's...
Move on before I get a headache.
Okay, moving on. So speaking of things that give people headaches, so you have to figure out what that, like, what your scenario is going to be. In the game that I ran, the scenario, I basically ripped off Deep Space Nine. I had the characters.
What was that really awesome line you had about, I didn't mean, something about Mass Effect, the plot of Mass Effect.
Yeah. Oh, where I said, I'm not saying I ripped off the plot of Mass Effect, but what I did was I ripped off the plot of Mass Effect.
Yeah.
Okay, I actually stole that from Red Letter Media, where I steal most of my lines.
There's nothing original, Orin. Nothing original.
No, everything's been done. Every main character is Jesus. Remember that.
Okay, I will remember that.
Okay, so, I just made my characters be the crew of a small patrol ship that was attached to a remote sector.
A non-canon one, mind you.
Yeah, of course, non-canon.
That actually stemmed from, you originally wanted to do a Miranda, and then you had thrown out there, you know, what's smaller than a Miranda, an Oberth?
Because I looked up and it was right? Miranda is like 200 crew, and I was like, yeah, that's a little big, I don't want to deal with that.
Well, for what you had in mind, it was too big anyway. Miranda itself is still a fairly small ship, you know. Compare, well, no, we were in 2340, and Master's the biggest one we got.
And Master has a crew of about 500.
Yeah, it's not.
The Ambassador is significantly larger than the Miranda. Like, an Ambassador has 2.5 times the crew of a Miranda, but is more than 5 times its size, which leads me to believe the Ambassador must have improved automation systems.
Something, but anyway. And I had thrown out, well, there's, like, these other ships in, like, Starfleet Command 2. There's the Okinawa, which is really tiny.
Well, because Bob didn't want to be flying an Oberth, and that was
the ship I didn't, because it's a really dumb, stupid, little, non-powerful ship that's not designed for patrols at all. It's, like, I think the only time we ever seen it for on-screen purposes was in Star Trek 3. It's in a scientific role, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was surveying the Genesis planet. And then we see it in TNG as
another science ship.
As a science ship, and then also as a cargo ship.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them also were decommissioned for civilian use.
TNG has rescued one a couple of times.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're not...
I mean, it's a small ship, but it...
It also looks like a space canoe.
It's like my adorable, goofy cousin.
Yeah. Okay, so...
what it is.
Well, Bob recommended to me an Okinawa-class patrol ship, which is perfect, because it had a very small crew. It only had 2 shuttles, which my players could not hold on to. They were losing shuttles, like, every other game. But I totally...
It's not our fault that Graham's shuttle character decided to take one for the team and put the shuttle in front of the, what was it, the Gorn ship?
Yeah.
And took the disruptor blast with the shuttle.
Yeah. Well, that happened.
Which, I mean, in actuality, it takes really good piloting to know exactly where the disruptor blast is going to hit the ship and then be in front of that. So.
Well, yeah. Well, the way that I justified it was that he was flying the shuttle and using his tractor beam to, like, push the Gorn ship around and just be a general nuisance. And so the Gorn decided to shoot at him instead of the ship.
No way, insect.
Well, because originally it was that he was shooting at the Gorn ship, and then I realized, like, 3 sessions later that these shuttles aren't armed. And I was like, oops, I goofed.
I done goofed.
And so I had to retcon it to be something else. And that was actually one of my favorite parts of the game, was that they kept losing shuttles, but Bob and Graham had both taken a rival as a disadvantage.
Who was the same guy?
Yeah, which I decided to make the same guy, because I didn't know if I was going to be able to bring him in anyway. And he never actually...
And who did he happen to be? The requisitions officer for the friggin' 6th Fleet that we were attached to.
Yep. And he never actually showed up, but he did screw them over from off-screen by refusing to give them a replacement shuttle. I love that guy.
For those that aren't aware, Graham actually does the voice for Gul'dan.
Yes.
On Tales from the DMZ, which another episode should be coming soon.
You know, I don't want to say that, because I'm working on it, but I've been working on it for, like, the last 2 months, and it's really my own fault. These things do take a long time to do, but I just haven't been putting enough work into it, so I will...
Well, you're a busy man.
I'm trying to get it done sooner. But, all right, so anyway, back to... I forgot what we were talking about. We were talking about the ship. Okay, so I chose the ship, and I chose the scenario of having them be in a sector that on the border of Gorn space, which by treaty law... Only each...
Well, it was like a corner with Klingon and Gorn's face.
Yeah, it was like Klingon and Gorn. And originally it was going to have Tholians in it too, but they never came up.
Mm-hmm.
And by a treaty that everyone had signed, each power was only allowed to have one, like, very small patrol ship in that sector for, like, anti-piracy and basically Coast Guard purposes.
Right.
And that was why they weren't allowed to call Starfleet for help, because Starfleet wasn't allowed to send any ships in.
Right.
And it also meant that, you know, I could save, like, the giant Gorn battlecruiser for the really big climactic session.
Such a big ship.
fucking huge. All right, so once I did that, the biggest problem that I had to decide was who was going to be my captain. And this is something you have to think about, and maybe it's not a problem for some groups, but I know in my group, it's always problematic to give one player any kind of authority over the other players, because I've just found that player characters, as a rule, reject authority in all forms, especially if it comes from another player character, because they just don't feel like they should have to do what that person says. And, like, there have been, I've had all kinds of bad experiences where I put the wrong person in charge, and only once, with a friend of mine named Spencer, that I really had, like, someone who just naturally took to command, and the other player just followed without question. Especially if this captain ends up, like, having to, like, reprimand someone or tell them they made a mistake, that just rubs player characters the wrong way. And again, maybe that's just my group, but I think that this is definitely a problem in other groups, too. So eventually what I did was I chose our friend Graham, because he has a good voice, and he can, you know, he can act the part very well, and then as a precaution, I made the first officer an NPC. That way, I could make sure that Graham didn't go mad with power and try to give the crew orders that didn't make sense, but I could also make sure that no one on the crew went, "You're not my real dad!"
You're not my real dad.
And refused to follow his orders for no reason.
Well, what made the first officer so scary is that she had RoboCop arms.
She did have RoboCop arms.
And threatened, actually, Graham's second character, as I recall, in some
vests. Well, she was high on
by putting a dent in the wall.
Well, she was high on painkillers and suffering from post-traumatic stress flashes at that time.
I feel this was irresponsible of the doctor to do that, especially when she had RoboCop arms.
Yeah, well, you know, it was definitely irresponsible. There was actually a whole subplot there that never actually happened, but regardless, so that was a thing that happened. That was Commander Vincent, who was actually a holdover from another game that I played, and the only reason she has robot arms is because I had a scene where I described her holding a blast door open, and I realized later, wait a minute, blast doors are like enormously powerful and like pushed down with a huge amount of force. There's no way one person could hold one open. I was like, well, I guess she has to have robot arms then. I make a lot of decisions this way. It's like, oh, that thing I did didn't make sense.
You could be a Star Trek writer.
Oh, man.
For Voyager.
Oh, God damn it, Bob. Ow.
I just want to stick that thorn in your side.
You did. It just ruined my entire day. And it was actually kind of funny, because I found out later that I actually could have just made Kelsey, who plays Glenn Ekman in Tales from the DMZ. I could have made her the captain, and everyone would have followed her orders, no problem. Because I have a theory that it's because she was the only girl in the group, and I think that the guys in the group just had less of a problem taking orders from a girl because it's like there's no, like, you know, manly rivalry thing going on there. And again, maybe that's not a problem for other groups. I just know it's a problem with my group. But anyway,
from my perspective as a player, sometimes I found it hard or difficult to take the orders that were being given because of the nerd Trek cred I've got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just me being, you know, such a Star Trek fan, I would know exactly what to do in a lot of these situations, which is why I told you I make a terrible captain, because I would just plow the adventure away.
Right, and that is kind of that's actually one of the big problems that I found with having one player in charge in of another, is that very often what will happen is that different players will have different ideas of what is actually going on based on the GM's description. And so the captain comes up with a solution, and he's like, I think, based on what the GM told me, this is what I think is going on, and this is the solution that I have to the problem. Because, of course, the players can't actually see what's happening in the universe. They rely completely on the GM's description of it. If another character heard the description and, like, came up with a different idea of what's going on, it's more than possible that the first player's idea will sound really stupid to them. And be like, that idea doesn't make any sense. But it's not because either player is dumb, it's just because they both have sort of different ideas of what's going on. Which is why, as the GM, I always try to clarify the intent and be like, alright, what are you trying to accomplish with this action you're proposing? And that way, it becomes very clear to everyone what's actually going on, and it's not just like, you know, like, for example, I had one instance where, I think this, I'm not positive this happened in the Star Trek game, this may have been a previous game that I'm remembering, but I had one instance where some of the players, like, wanted to turn and fight this other ship, and the others were like, they wanted to leave, and it was just that the first group of players were under the impression that this was not a very powerful ship, and the second group of players were under the impression that it was a very powerful ship. And in fact, it was not a very powerful ship. They had just misunderstood me. And so once we cleared up what was going on, everything made more sense. And so we didn't have a bunch of players yelling at each other and arguing over what the correct solution was. Now, that's completely different from an in-character discussion where you can have two people having a disagreement. And that's fine. That can be a lot of fun, in fact. But when you have two characters who, because of purely in-character reasons, want to do different things. So, and I totally encourage that. Like, I know that we had a couple of instances where Jim's character wanted to read some people's minds, and other characters were not okay with that, and that was a purely in-character argument, and that was awesome. I really liked that. But anyway, so that's some role-playing theory to lay down on you.
Well, some of the things that the players can do to clarify what the GM is talking about is, one, to ask questions, right? Or they have the skills that are available to them. You know, like, for instance, you know, some characters may have, you know, sensor analysis.
Yeah.
So they can look at their sensors and see exactly what's going on or get a better description that way from the GM. You know, but it's always also, it's not always on the GM necessarily to be like, hey, this is going on, and then just expect everybody to get it right off the bat. The players also have to have the presence of mind to go, okay, well, I didn't really get this. We obviously have differing ideas. Let's go ask the GM what exactly is going on here.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's totally true. And so the one aspect of the character creation that I forgot to cover was advantages and disadvantages. And this is not something that D&D has, but a lot of systems have this where you can, they're not skills or stats, they're just different, you know, they're different traits that your character can have that are either good or bad. D&D kind of has them with feats.
World of Darkness has them, doesn't it?
Not really. World of Darkness, old World of Darkness had merits and flaws. New World of Darkness has merits, and they technically have flaws, but they're in the very back of the book. No one ever takes them because they're kind of weird. They don't really work very well with the rest of the game. But basically, the idea is that advantages cost points, disadvantages give you points. And a disadvantage is any kind of character flaw, like
being drunk.
Like being an alcoholic, or being a coward, or having some kind of phobia. And disadvantages are often very interesting, and sometimes it can be very bland to play a character that doesn't have any disadvantages. Now, at the same time, I have to caution any group playing in a system that has disadvantages, watch out for players who load up on a bunch of role-playing disadvantages that don't really have any mechanical effect just so they can get a bunch of free points. It's something that I see happen a lot, and I'm not saying that that person who does that is necessarily a bad player or somebody you don't want to play with. A lot of times it's something they do subconsciously. They don't even realize they're doing it. But when you look at a character sheet and it has, like, lost love and, like, fascination poetry, and, you know, and, like, phobia purple-green spiders or, like, a bunch of random crap that's not ever going to come up, you have to say, all right, hold on here, mister. Hold on. The same thing with, like, if someone has, like, rival, like, five times on their character sheet. It's like, you know, I have five rivals, and it's like, well, that's the sort of thing that is a story point, but it doesn't actually mechanically hinder the character in any way, the same way that, like, taking lame leg would, or taking a stat penalty in dexterity would.
Well, it doesn't even say in the character creation guide, and also the when you level up as well on the experience table for spending experience that you gain, to check with your GM.
Yes.
Or I think they use the word narrator in this one, I think.
Yeah, probably.
Check with your GM on your character.
Yeah, that's always something that you should do. It's
that should be really any system.
Yeah, but sometimes, like, I know that as a GM, sometimes I have gotten to the point where the character creations is done, and I've just sort of briefly glanced at each character and not really noticed certain issues. I really advise GMs to take the time to look over each character, talk about them with the players, even if it means you don't actually play on your first session. If your first session is just character creating, that's fine.
Well, typically most of the groups I've been in, that's what they do, is that first session is all about making those characters is what it is. Because character creation does take a long time to do.
Yeah, especially in systems like this.
In systems like this, World of Darkness, I find, Burning Wheel.
Actually, World of Darkness is, New World of Darkness character generating is really quick, unless you're dealing with people who don't know the system.
Well, I didn't.
But, like, just a base World of Darkness character you can make in, like, 15 minutes, because it has all the information you need right there on the character sheet. You hardly have to look at the book. But Burning Wheel takes forever.
Yeah.
Burning Wheel takes a long time. A lot of high-level D&D games take a long time. Stuff like that. So I really advise everyone to, you know, especially because it's, you know, if you, like, and you really, as a GM, you want to sit down and think about certain disadvantages, like, say, Rival, I'll use as a good example, and you have to think, is there really room in your story for another NPC? Or can you make one of your existing NPCs into the player's rival? Because if not, don't let them take it, because that's boring. It's really boring if they just have this rival on their character sheet who just never shows up. And some stories do not have room for one. They just won't happen. Same thing with allies. And I actually feel kind of bad about this. I am guilty. I know that a couple of my players took, like, ally or patron or some version of that where they had, like, a friendly NPC. They just never showed up because I forgot about it. And my story was already really crowded with NPCs. And so it was just like, well, that just didn't happen. Those were just wasted character points. So that's something you have to be really careful with. And then by the same token, I also had this character who's, because I'm a, like, I love referencing my own stuff. Savay from Tales from the DMZ was in this story as a Starfleet captain, because this is back during her actual career. And she was basically an ally for Kelsey's character, even though Kelsey never paid any points for her. It was just an NPC that I wanted to have in the game. And so that's, you know, that's something you have to be kind of careful of. And then, of course, with advantages, there are certain ones that are going to be a little broken, and you have to be careful with them. The Star Trek RPG, I don't think it actually has any that are super broken, with the exception of possibly... there's one advantage that just makes you immune to telepathy, which can be kind of annoying. But it's that depends on what game you're playing in and if it's going to have a lot of telepaths in it.
Right.
My game did have a lot of telepaths in it, so I didn't want telepathy. My game was all about telepathy, so I didn't want anyone just being immune to telepathy, because that would have not been very fun. So now you have some characters, and you've decided who's going to be in charge, you've assigned roles. Another thing you have to think about with a Star Trek game specifically is how, like, realistic you want to get. Because you can go the full TOS mode and just say whatever. Like, the captain, the first officer, the medical officer, and Ensign Ricky are all going to go down to wherever the problem is and deal with it every week. But a lot of role players will say, hey, why are the senior officers beaming down to deal with this problem? Why aren't we sending someone else who isn't vital to running the ship to deal with this problem? And so you have to kind of decide what level of realism you want with that. And because, like, this isn't like a band of adventurers killing orcs, everyone on the ship has a job. And this is a job that, in theory, they aren't just going to abandon the moment something interesting happens. So, like, as a GM, you have to make sure that you craft your scenarios in such a way that everyone gets to participate. Because it's kind of lame if half the players get to go do their thing, or most of the players get to go, you know, be part of the adventure, but then, like, the ops officer stays behind and runs the ship, because that's what that's his job.
Right.
Or by the same token, if the captain is a responsible captain and he decides it would be irresponsible of me to go into this potentially dangerous situation, I'm going to stay on the ship. Well, if your adventure involved the potentially dangerous situation, that captain is just not going to do anything.
Right.
So you have to be careful. And the way that I handled this was that I actually had everyone create two characters. I had, you know, the A-cast characters who were the command officers, and then I had everyone make a lower-level character who was an ensign who was part of, an away team. Uh-huh. And, you know, you guys were the most pro away team and got sent on all kinds of missions where you lost all the shuttles.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I wasn't there when they decided to trade the shuttle away for something with the Cardassian underlord or whatever it was.
That was awesome. They traded a shuttle to a Cardassian crime boss because they needed his help.
Yeah, that's a thing that happened.
It did happen. It was rad. So in that situation, I would sort of designate whether the session was going to be a command session or an away session. Based sort of on if it was going to be, like, if it was a diplomacy mission, chances are it was going to be everyone playing their command officers, because those are the guys who make the big decisions.
Right.
Or if it was a ship combat mission, chances are it was going to be a command game. But if it was like...
You mean my xenoarchaeologist can't man the phaser banks?
Not as a rule, no. But if it was like, you know, there's some weird... We found some weird ruins on this planet. You guys should go down and take a look. It'll be the away team.
And then Gorn commandos show up.
Yep.
Try to ruin your shit.
Or like, you know, there's a Gorn freighter that needs some help. We're going to send an away team over to fix their ship up. And it'll be great. They have comfy chairs.
Mm-hmm. The comfiest of chairs.
Yeah. That's an away team job. And then there were certain sessions where I was like, this session is big enough and important to the story enough that you can sometimes switch between playing. And that's kind of, you know, switch between playing either. And that's kind of
risky. Or we were doing multiple things where we're using our away team characters and our command characters for stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a neat idea, and it worked for us in certain... In other games, I've tried that, and it hasn't worked. Players sometimes get confused between which character they're playing and, like, you know, their characters start to act kind of weird because they're in the... You know, they're in a mode to play their hard-ass security officer, but then they switch over to their, you know, to their Peace and Flowers counselor, and they're like, and they start playing him like the security officer, and it gets, you know. So sometimes that's a little confusing, but it worked well for us. It may not work for every group, but I just say that when you are looking at running a Star Trek game, really think about, when you make each session, how your players are going to get involved. And the easiest way, honestly, is to just have something happen to the ship and on wherever the adventure is. That way the people who stay back on the ship can, you know, have something to do. It works out pretty great. Okay, so...
In Orin's case, he has half the crew go homicidal maniac rampage, and the other crew, half the crew, is the horrible victims of it.
Yeah, exactly. That only happened
once. So my character died.
Yeah, it is. Well, that was the other conclusion, was that the big evil space alien thing was trying to get into everyone's brains, and, like, you know, trying to get you to lower your shield so it could get more into your brains.
Yeah.
And, you know, your character didn't want to do that. And
I didn't want to do that.
So he had to get shot.
I did get shot for it, it's true.
And And then, of course, although Star Trek does offer a one very unique perk, which is that if you have a character die, you can very easily explain how the new character gets added to the group, because he gets Starfleet sends them a replacement. And I didn't actually have anyone die halfway through the game. I had one person die at the very last session. But, you know, that can be a potential issue, is integrating a new character into the group. But anyway, so once you've...
We'd had someone join the group. We had two people join the group, didn't we?
Kind of. We had,
Jim, who was on and off, and then we had Cam.
Yeah, Cam joined the group about halfway through. And, you know, and again, it was just like, Starfleet has assigned you a new officer. Enjoy it. Have fun. Whereas Jim's character
wasn't... opened your duty officer pack. And look what popped out.
And so, whereas Jim's character wasn't actually part of the crew, he was assigned to the station that they were part of. So that was how... He was a recurring guest star, but he wasn't actually part of the main cast. Whew. Okay. Sorry, I've been talking a whole lot. All right. So... switch back to a little bit of the nitty-gritty for a minute here. The Star Trek system, one of the problems that it runs into is in combat, primarily with phasers.
Oh, man.
Okay, so for some reason, this game has decided that if you set your phaser to maximum, the setting is Heavy Disrupt G, and that is its 16th setting. Because remember, they made a brief mention in a DS9 episode that Federation weapons have 16 beam settings. So what they decided that meant is that on level 16, your phaser will do 160 plus 12d6 of damage.
Now, put that in perspective. Now, how much health does the average character have?
Well, hold on a minute. I'm getting to that. the description on that is that is enough to blast like 100 cubic meters of rock to rubble. And so the average character has 6, 12, 18, 24, 36, 48 hit points.
Mm-hmm.
So even on a lower setting, it's very easy to set your phasers high enough that they will just one-shot anyone that you hit. Now, and the same thing with the stun setting. If your stun setting is on heavy stun, there are very few characters that will stand, that will keep standing after they've been hit by a phaser. Now, that is in keeping with the Star Trek setting. And honestly, it would be really weird if you were running forward and getting hit by like four phaser blasts and not falling over.
Right.
However, this does come up with a couple of problems. The first problem is that if you set your phaser, like, heavy stun will incapacitate someone really quickly. However, once you set your phaser to the next highest setting, you have this weird drop-off where suddenly, like, light and heavy thermal, which are the settings above heavy stun, are actually way less effective at dropping characters than heavy stun is. Like, if you set your phaser to kill, it's actually way harder to knock someone down. You have to turn it up really high before you have a certainty that you will actually kill someone with a phaser hit. So, like, that's a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps weirder is that you have to really change the mindset of players about combat. Because, like, most players who have played D&D, they just think of combat as the way that they solve problems. It's like, there is a thing in my way, I have to fight it to get to the thing I want.
Right.
But if you approach combat that way in a Star Trek role-playing game, you will be in trouble. Because it is so easy to just completely one-shot all of your characters with one hit from the opposing team, that if they get lucky and hit your characters more times than your characters hit them, they just win. And then you have to figure out what happens. It's like, okay, well, you really weren't supposed to lose that fight.
Game over.
So you have to be careful not to send your characters into situations where they are not supposed to lose a fight, because they very easily could.
Uh-huh.
And there's not a whole lot you can do once they do. You have to come up, you have to pull some reason out of your ass why they're not all dead.
Right.
And the same thing happened. Wait, hold on, I completely lost my train of thought. Uh-oh. All right, okay, so the way that they solve this in the Star Trek show is they just have everyone be really crappy at shooting. Because you'll notice in Star Trek is infamous for having...
I think they're really good.
You
actually,
do?
I do, in given what we see them hit. What we see them hit all the time are very, very small things.
Well, I mean, in Deep Space Nine, maybe. But, like, if you look at other shows, Star Trek is notorious for having people be bad at phaser fighting.
Well, you see clean misses most of the time in TNG,
right? Yeah.
I think the longest phaser fight we saw was in Discounting Best of Both Worlds, where they hit every single Borg pretty much to come their way because they're, you know, shooting down hallways, was in Gambit, the first part, where they beam down to the planet, where there's this archaeological dig there, because they're trying to figure out who killed Picard, right? Because they all think Picard's dead the first half of the episode.
Right.
And they have this exchange of fire with the mercenary crew. Right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of those are clean misses. Sometimes they hit the rocks that they're hidden behind. So, you know, that worked okay. But in DS9, for instance, you see a lot of them shooting and, what was the name of the episode? The three-parter they had. The last one. I think it was The Siege is the last one.
This,
It was the Circle.
In season two.
Circle or something, and then the Siege, I think, is the third one.
Yeah, yeah, I remember. The one where the crazy Bajorans try to take over the space station.
Right, and you have the phaser fight going on the promenade. Those bars are really small and are not providing a lot of cover.
No,
you know?
But they keep
missing. But they hit them, like, every single time.
It's the same thing with the, in that same set of episodes where they beam down to rescue Kira from the caves, and they're just, like, shooting and somehow missing the guys who are standing, like, 10 feet away, and... Like, no, it's not happening. And then, again, you see it in Blaze of Glory. And these are all DS9 episodes, actually, which is kind of sad. In Blaze of Glory, there's this situation where Sisko and Eddington are down on a moon that's covered. That's like, there's supposed to be some fog, but the fog's not very thick. And I guess maybe there's a conceit of the show that the fog is thicker than it actually looks, because if it was really thick, we couldn't see what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't look very thick. And somehow the Jem'Hadar are missing them from, like, you know, a few feet away. And it's like, I just sort of assume the Jem'Hadar were better shots than that. And of course, in Voyager, their solution was that getting hit by a phaser isn't actually too bad. But there are a number of times in Voyager and later Enterprise where, like, people get hit with weapons, like energy weapons, and they get up and walk away. And it's like, really? Like, center of mass, direct hit, and the two ones that I can think of off the top of my head are in the 37s, I think I've mentioned this before, where Amelia Earhart's, like, co-pilot gets hit in the chest with a phaser, and he just walks off.
The well, phaser thing. Was set on stun, though, wasn't it?
Well, no, it was a. I mean, it may have been set on stun. I don't know. It was the. It was the weapons being used by the humans who lived on that planet, who thought that the Starfleet people were the aliens that had enslaved them.
Oh.
So okay. I doubt they had their weapons set on stun. But he doesn't even go unconscious. He gets hit like right in the chest, and then he like scrambles up and leaves. And the same thing happens when Chakotay gets hit by a Kazon weapon. It's like, I really doubt the Kazon have their weapons on stun. I assume that the Kazon weapons are set to murder
shoot
you.
Shoot to kill.
But anyway, so this is all just illustrating the problems with phasers in a role-playing game. But their only problem is if you set up your scenario with the assumption that combat is an unavoidable conclusion. You really have to, like, instill in the players that violence is a last resort. Both because it's a Starfleet ideal and because... You don't know what they've got. They could get lucky, and then you'd be dead.
Pulling out a phaser, serious you know, shit. This shit yeah. got real.
You don't pull out a phaser unless shit has gotten real. And then, move into plot construction. This segues very naturally. You have to figure out what kinds of stories you want to tell. And again, traditional role-playing games have a lot of fighting. You typically go and you fight someone. There's a story about how you're fighting this guy.
Defeat the wizard in the tower.
Yeah, exactly. So, but with Star Trek, so many Star Trek stories are not about fighting. And if you really want to capture the Star Trek idea, you have to try to make it so that all the characters have skill levels that, like, their skills are just as important as people who are combat characters. And, like, Bob, for example, you were playing an engineer, and your other character was a xenobiologist.
Archaeologist.
Xenoarchaeologist, excuse me.
Or sociologist, really. He had a lot of social science skills.
Yeah. But I tried to make Bob's engineering skills and his science skills be just as important as someone else's phaser skill. And I don't know if I succeeded, but I tried really hard. And that's like...
Well, they became essential due to how the story unfolded with, you know, the... Oh, gosh, what were they called? The Gorn Jesus guys.
Oh, the Sestians?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they were from Cestus 3.
Yeah, because I'm a xenoarchaeologist, I'm really kind of the only guy that's got the train to figure this stuff out. So, I mean, that worked out really well. The engineer, he's dealing with the ship operations.
Yeah, he was keeping the ship from blowing up.
Yeah, really a lot of my chief engineer's exploits had to do with just screwing around the station and getting laid by Klingons.
That did happen a lot. Also, you were a primary source of technobabble, which I appreciated.
Well, you know.
But, you know, you want missions that are about... You have to figure out how to make, like, you know, science exploration missions interesting to players. Now... The people on the show actually have a much easier job doing this than you do, because they get to use spectacle. They can show you this awesome shot of this planet and the spaceship and show you all this cool science tech that's going on. As a game master, you have to describe all that. And unless you have, like, you know, God's own voice, you're going to have a hard time describing that in a way that's interesting for more than a few minutes. So you have to come up with some kind of drama that isn't just, let's go fight a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not to say that you can't ever fight monsters. I fought plenty of monsters in my day, and I had my players fight some monsters too, and that was sometimes fun. But you have to have some sessions that are not about that. And then ideally, you also want some diplomatic missions. And again, this is, of course, you have to spice to taste, as it were. Your different groups will have different ideas. It's very possible you will have a group that wants to run a Star Trek game, but really just wants to shoot Klingons. Or maybe wants to be Klingons. I don't know. And you know
that'll be the next game.
they're not really that interested in the whole like science and exploration thing. But I knew that my players, either because they were Star Trek fans or because I was a huge Star Trek fan and I was imposing my desires on them, wanted to do stuff other than just shoot people. And so, you know, diplomacy missions are really big in Star Trek, and I had a lot of fun with some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of which, I really don't understand why this game doesn't have a social conflict resolution system.
Like Burning Wheel?
Yeah, like Burning Wheel, because I love talking about Burning Wheel.
Burning Wheel has a fantastic, it's called Duel of Wits, right?
Yeah, the Duel of Wits.
You should describe that really quick, because okay. I think it's a really good system, too.
So, all right, so you know how, like, combat is effectively a conflict resolution system. It's like, you know, I want this thing, or I want something to happen, and another person, usually an NPC, occasionally a player character, I don't go in for PvP, but occasionally another player character, wants the opposite, or he doesn't want you to get what you want. Mm-hmm. So you have this system for resolving who gets what, like who gets what they want and who's dead. So what Burning Wheel did was they were like, hey guys, what if we had a system like that, but for social situations? So your social system wasn't just resolving everything with one die roll and having it be like, well, I won my diplomacy check.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is the way the system works is that each player scripts a maneuver, and your maneuvers are things like make a point,
counterpoint,
dismiss, rebuttal, counterpoint, obfuscate. Obfuscate is my favorite.
Yes.
and you role play these, and each maneuver has a specific mechanical role, and has different skills that you use, and you drive down your opponent's, it's called a body of argument, but it's basically their social hit points.
Right.
And once you have driven them down and they have no more body of argument or social hit points left, you have won, and whatever you were trying to accomplish has occurred. Or if they win, whatever they were trying to accomplish has occurred. Be that, you know, they're going to sign this trade agreement, or you're going to throw this war criminal in prison. And you see that kind of thing all the time in Star Trek shows. Like, you know that, for example, there was totally a duel of wits going on between Kira and Sisko about whether or not Kira was going to investigate Eamon Maritza in Duet. Right. That whole scene was a duel of wits, and Kira totally won that duel of wits. And she was like, no, I am going to, you know, I'm going to be investigating this. And there are a number of others. Like Odo is, when Odo linked with, like when Odo was talking to the female changeling, that's a duel of wits that takes place over like 4 days. And that's like an extended duel of wits.
Right.
So those things totally happen in Star Trek, but there's no mechanics for them. So you have to resolve, mechanically you resolve a social interaction with one die roll. And it's just kind of, as a GM, you have to come up with more drama to it than that. And you could, you know, I didn't go this far, but you could have always go ahead and homebrew your own social conflict system.
I think you should make one next time you run a Star Trek game.
Yeah, I might. But
or
that,
someone else runs it, for instance, hand it to them. Be like, mm-hmm. Hey, you should really use this.
That goes against my entire idea of doing as little work as possible.
Sometimes sacrifices have to be made for the greater good, Orin.
Yeah, that's true. And so, like, that's something that I really wish there was more of. I also really wish that there was a mass combat system, because towards the end of the game, I was having big fleet engagements, and anyone who's ever seen Deep Space Nine or played any of the Star Trek video games is going to want to do fleet engagements. But there are no mechanics for them. Like, there is a ship combat mechanic in this game, but it's kind of weird and hard to follow and very technical. And we never used it just because it was very clunky. So what I really wanted something a little more elegant that would be more than just the two commanders rolling their opposed space tactics at each other.
Uh-huh.
And, like, again, the Burning Empires, which is the sci-fi version of Burning Wheel, has such a system, and it works really well. And so does the Game of Thrones.
If you love Burning Empires and Burning Wheel so much, why don't you marry it, huh?
Not legal in the state yet.
Oh, okay.
But the Game of Thrones system has a similar mass battle mechanic, and it's really cool, and I really like it.
You could just play Starfleet battles.
Yeah, you could be. You could. You could just, you could resolve every conflict you get into by playing Starfleet battles. Yeah, pardon me. I need some water. This is what happens when I talk very loudly about role playing games. All right, what else we got in here? There's more stuff. I know. I have barely scratched the surface of this game. Bobby, yeah. Anything you want to add about this?
I had a lot of fun playing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really all that intimidating at first, just seeing how character creation works. I mean, aside from the fact that it's split up in a really weird way.
Yeah.
You know, to where it's in one half of the book and then the other half is in the later half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The whole bunch of stuff in between that hasn't been explained to you yet. So that was a little intimidating off the bat. But, you know, once you kind of got it figured out and you saw how the packages work and once the skills were explained, I felt it was really easy to play a character. I thought it was a really good idea to split up the away team characters and the command crew characters, or make those two different characters anyway, so that the command crew isn't going on these missions. Or to replicate scenes, for instance, from the show, where we see, for instance, like Data and Geordi fixing the plasma conduit in Tech 42 next to the antimatter pods. Why are they doing that? Why isn't, you know, the crewman that got hired on the ship not too long ago doing this? I mean, why is it so important that they're doing it? It's not important.
Yeah.
You know, the difference being, you know, between this game is that we're dealing with a lot more of our player or and viewer preconceptions of what we think should be going on, as opposed to what's taking place story-wise in the show. I mean, the show, it's an opportunity for these two characters to talk about something in the A plot or B plot, and that affects them emotionally, or they think this thing is a bad idea, because otherwise we'd just see them in their office or in 10 Forward.
Yeah.
Right, this is where we'd see those things going on. You know, I really liked it, I think, with some refinements to the system, like, for instance, adding in, like, a social conflict system, like you were saying. Adding in something like that, also streamlining the fleet engagement stuff, you know, things like that. But the one thing I want to mention about my preference for role-playing games is not so much that our characters are extraordinary individuals. I mean, a lot of role RPGs that I've seen are definitely geared towards players being these really epic heroes or being, you know, above the common man, right?
Right.
The stories I really like and appreciate and the games that I play that I really like and appreciate are to where you are, in fact, a common individual and you go do extraordinary things. But you've done it through not because you are an extraordinary individual, but because you employed your cunning and your wit to do it.
Right. And that's totally a valid idea. The question, the issue being that if you're going to do that, you have to make the game for that. Like, if you make a game assuming that everyone's going to be an exceptional individual and then they're not, you kind of have some problems. So you have to, like, set the stakes to, at an appropriate level, and you have to provide some kind of, like, justification for how characters who are significantly less skilled than your typical RPG character are going to be able to succeed in these situations. And you can do that either by, like, you know, you can have, like, very low-scale games. Like, one time I ran a Burning Wheel game that was just a bunch of villagers.
And I loved that game. I loved that game to death.
But you'll notice in that game, you guys weren't, like, fighting dragons every day.
We weren't, and that's fine.
And that was awesome.
It was the way the conflicts were presented to us, which I really liked about that particular game. You know, it's like these are still things that are very much at stake for us. You know, like I wasn't there for this particular scenario, but it was, you know, relayed to me that, you know, the town water supply had been poisoned. You guys were really sure why.
Yep.
And it turned out some other, like, wolves or something like that were dealing with it or something like that. I don't recall exactly what it was.
What happened there was, this is actually, I'm actually pretty proud of the storyline. Okay, so what happened there was that the big baddie of the first arc of this game was, like, an ancient demon wolf who had been awoken by some other event that happened before the game even started. And he was, like, hanging out north of the village, and he was really weak because he'd been asleep for, like, a thousand years. But he had control over all the regular wolves. And he was basically, like, laying siege to the town with wolves. And at one point, what they started doing was they started killing, like, all the game around that they could find. So they were starving the town out, and then they would drag the bodies into the river that fed the town. Or drag the corpses, I should say. And the corpses would rot in this pool that all the water had to go through, and so all the water was contaminated.
Right. And, but the thing is that the common town folk were the ones that had to fix this problem.
Right.
Not the adventurer party that just happened in the town that day and found out that there was some problem where they're just going to go kill some wolves off in the wilderness and get their 10 experience.
I also had an adventure where some random adventurers came into the town and were being huge assholes. And the characters actually had to get them all killed because these adventurers were just taking all the town's food and, like, assuming that the town was going to help them in any way possible. And eventually started making advances on some of the local townswomen, and the players were like, oh, okay, we can't deal with this anymore. These adventurers are going to ruin our town if we let them stay
here. Yeah, in those cases, though, it was typically the players with their own wit having to come up with these plans to try to solve these problems,
exactly.
And their skills being supplement to that, as opposed to having your skills solve these problems for you, and then the character or the player intellect being supplement to that.
True.
You know, and I kind of feel Star Trek RPG is definitely in that same vein, because I didn't feel overpowered at any point. Like, I could definitely see how you could break the math, you know, to where you could have, like, the super character that does all these things really, really well and then is not bad at anything. You know, look up Tom Paris from Voyager, anyway.
Yeah.
What is he? Medic, pilot, commando, squad leader?
Holonovelist.
Holonovelist. Yeah, he can just do all these things really well. I don't think any of our characters had too big of a list of skills that they could do really well, but they still had the skills that were appropriate to their characters. And a lot of things that we had to go out and do, we still had to discuss them, come up with these plans, and then see what skills we had to implement that plan.
Right, exactly. And again, and that's why it's so important to, and this is a lesson for all RPGs, it's always important to scale your challenges to your characters. Like, it's because you really, I've been in a situation before where the GM has presented me with a problem. Like, presented, and by me, I mean the whole group, with a problem where that was so high above us that there was no credible way for us to solve it. Like, one time, I was playing in a Call of Cthulhu game that was inspired by Lost, where we all crashed on an island, and, like, we were playing the survivors of the plane crash. So we were just, like, normal people. Like, we were told, just make normal people who would be on a plane. But, like, the people we were supposed to overcome were, like, these paramilitary magical cultists who had, like, you know, old ancient, like, deep ones on their side and, like, magic tech and, like, the color out of space and all this crazy shit. And it got to the point where the GM literally just had to hand wave us through each encounter. And it was really incredible. It was uncredible. It was like, we should have died in the first scene.
That sounds like they were trying to tell a story, but they had such a specific idea for the story that the players couldn't decipher what was supposed to happen.
Exactly. What ended up happening
was... Yeah, that's way too far the other direction.
Yeah, what happened in the other... What actually ended up happening at the end was that a bunch of, like, Navy SEAL commandos showed up and basically solved the scenario for us. And I was like, if this is the game you wanted to run, we should have been those commandos. Because that way we actually would have had the skills and the equipment to credibly deal with the situation. Now, I also played a Call of Cthulhu game where we were just some random dilettantes who decided to make an occult society because we thought it would be fun. And then we ran into, like, a real monster and we had no idea how to deal with it. And that was a lot of fun. That was fun because it was a very low-powered monster. It was like I think it was like some kind of, like, ghoul thing. And it wasn't, like, you know, an unstoppable killing machine, so it was something we could deal with, even though we were not playing super high-level characters.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the words of wisdom I will leave you with, and I will give The Last Unicorn, Star Trek RPG, I'd say a fairly positive review. It works once you can get past its horrible formatting.
Well, I think what saves it is the setting.
Yeah, well, definitely. That's true.
I mean, minus replicators.
Yeah, I would never play... yeah, I would definitely not play the system if it wasn't the Star Trek system. And, of course, I always set my games in a point before replicators. But we've already covered replicators. So with that, this is All Things Trek signing off. Thank you for listening to All Things Trek. This show is distributed under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which means please share it, but don't change it or sell it. Remember, resistance is futile.